All right. So how many of you knew that was going to be the walk-in music? Right? Yes. So, a week of Ignite. It's been really awesome. I think overall, we've done pretty well. I need to borrow this. So, with any luck, you've learned a bunch of stuff. You've made a lot of connections. You've gotten some of your questions answered. You've gotten to talk to people. Did any of you get to make some stuff at the Maker Den? Excellent. Hey, really quick for me, how many of you, this is your first Ignite? Oh, that's great. Been here before? Hang on, some of you must be tourists. What? All right. Welcome back. Welcome to Ignite. So one of the things we like to think about when we're doing this is all the stuff you guys do, what you consume, how it works, right? So when you think about it, Tech Ed, when we did it in 2013, we ended up with a bunch of servers on site, 24 blades with 192 gigs of RAM each. This Ignite, zero on site, 100% run from the cloud. That's kind of cool, right? You guys can run the same stuff in your infrastructure or wherever you want. How many of you went to some Azure Stack sessions? Pretty slick stuff. Build on Azure Stack, transfer it to Azure, it all works. So then we look at some of the other things we've done, right? You guys ended up downloading almost 3 terabytes of stuff on this network. Telstra thanks you. It's pretty cool. And we were watching for downloads of Halo and Fallout 4 and stuff. Nobody played Fallout 4 yet, have you? Okay, well, maybe you did. So we've also done stuff. We have a whole bunch of network infrastructure we run around here. Dual routers, we do redundant ISP paths. Our peak wireless usage, 1,723 concurrent users. How many of you want that kind of infrastructure in your workplace? Oh, well, we kind of have it. That's cool. You can just come back here and do your work from here. That'd be good. So we ended up with a couple gigabit links. We have edge ports everywhere. We have over 10 gigabits of core fiber running this event, right? And one of the things that it does is it helps facilitate us not only running demos, but helping you learn. So how many of you got to go up to the hands-on labs and the education training? That's excellent. The other guys with the colorful hats were helping you out up there, right? We ended up with 2,042 hands-on labs that were run. And the technical learning guides up there, the other guys with the colorful hats, collectively there's over 238 years of MCT and MVP experience that was upstairs helping you guys out. That is pretty slick in my opinion, okay? You guys went through over 843 different labs, and you spent over 2,200 hours in those labs. That's a lot of work for 4 days. You did well. Now, we had some exams that we were running here, and we found the most popular one, Azure Infrastructure Solutions. That's what we're talking about. Going to the cloud, getting stuff done, infinite computing power in your palm of your hand. Now, we had exam certifications here and the exam cram sessions. We ended up with over 250 of those that you guys attended, right? And to do all this, how much did you have to stay awake? You guys drank over 18,000 cups of coffee to get that done. That's a crap ton of coffee. That's almost as much as I have in a month. Right? There is somebody I'd like to have a shout out to, though. Ray Brindley. Are you here, Ray? Ah, Ray Brindley. Congratulations. Took 2 exams, passed them both first try up there. Nice job. Come see me after this. I have something for you, okay? Because I think that's some cool work. All right. Now, it wouldn't be a good lock note if we didn't have a good lock note speaker. So this time, we've brought Dr. Jason Fox, and he's the author of The Game Changer, and he's got a new book coming out called How to Lead a Quest. And now that you've got all this knowledge, he's going to give you some tools to take back that you'll be able to put into effect when you get home to to make sure you don't forget it, and you can do this stuff. You can accomplish it, okay? So let's welcome Dr. Fox to the stage.
Thank you. Sweet. Shall we? See, I told you it would be awkward. Oh, cool. I always stuff up the handshakes. I'm like the most awkward handshake high five person you can get. I can't read people some these days, like, because there's too many cool things going out. You don't know if it, anyway. I'm quite honored that we're all here, given that Fallout is out and we could all be playing that. The lock note normally is the time that we all get pumped and enthused, and I saw a lot of energy in the videos that were shared before, but just a bit of a caveat, I'm possibly the most introverted motivational speaker you'll come across. I find that the world of motivation is fraught with overly extroverted alpha males with big teeth that talk about horrendous concepts like big, hairy, audacious goals and throbbing targets. And if you're inclined towards introversion, it can be a little bit disconcerting. And my intention here is to ensure that later when you're back and your bosses and your coworkers are saying, so what was that event like? And you're saying, oh, it was great, you know, blah, 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 you had to be there, that maybe we've got something to show for it. Maybe we've got something that we can help progress here. And so what I'd like to hone in on as we get into my keynote is really how we can go about embarking upon a quest. Some of the things that you have at the moment, I dare say, are just hunches. They're not even clear things that you have, and you don't even know exactly what the goal is, but you've got this hunch, this sense that something different could be achieved. Most of the classic tools don't work for that. I mean, are there any introverts in the room? Just put up your hand. Yeah, right, yeah. So hardcore introverts don't put up their hand, do they? They just glance briefly at you and then resume judging you. And that's fine, that's totally how I roll too. Some extroverts would have put up their hands because they love the attention. But I find myself, like, I find if you're like me, you find this, and by the way, let's not get carried away with labels. Introverts can do extroverted things and vice versa. It's all about, it's like a pendulum. It's all about where you're resting and you recharge, like where you go to recharge your mana. I find myself doing this thing where I'll take what people say quite literally, particularly if they use the word literally. So I've been at events before where we're pretty good at the moment, but I've been at events where someone's come up to me and said, oh, it's so cold in here, I'm literally freezing my ass off. Which, as someone with a background in science, gets me really curious. I think instantly in that moment, how? How are you doing this? And the best in that, it's happened more than once, I could deduce is liquid nitrogen sachets attached to her backside, just slowly, literally freezing it off, which is an interesting life choice. And then I think, what might be the antecedents to this behavior? Maybe it's something to do with the National Disability Insurance Scheme that's going on, and you know, there's quite an intelligent thing going on there. I don't know. I have people that come up to me and say, ha, that was so funny, I literally peed my pants, and I can't help but check, and then get really perplexed in this moment, like, it doesn't appear that you have, and I'm not sure why you would lie to me about such a thing. So you can imagine what it's like for me, and we've all been in this, when you've been to a phenomenal event. You've had not just the intriguing sessions where you've learned about HoloLenses and all sorts of fancy new things that the rest of the world hasn't even got a clue about yet. Not just about the conversations you've had with your buddies in the breaks and the new people you've met. And then you get to this end bit, and you have this experience. Like, I've seen a guy that was literally like, this is like a closing keynote. I saw a guy once. Well, this is my first encounter with a motivational speaker was when I was in high school, and it was a 43 degree day, and there was this guy in a pinstripe suit sweating over his collar, and we're all sitting on the floor and the gymnasium floor, and teachers were in their plastic chairs, and this guy started, and he started on stage like this. You all need a checkup from the neck up. Do you know what I'm saying? Okay. Because right now, I see a whole bunch of amazing people, okay? But you don't realize how amazing you are. You don't realize how amazing you are, because in order to be amazing, you need to be amazing, okay? You need to be amazing. The moment you realize that you don't have to become a millionaire, you already are a millionaire whose money just has not been deposited in the bank account yet, okay? That is the day, all right? In order to achieve, you need to believe. So repeat after me, conceive, believe, achieve. Anyway, we're all fist pumping and so on. I just cough the words. bullshit into my hands. As, not really. I wasn't that cool. I was playing Magic the Gathering in the room library at lunchtime. There's a cool kid near me that said that, and I thought, oh, I wish I had said that. Growing up with red hair is character building. The thing is, it had an effect. We were pumped. We were enthused. And this lasted all the way through to lunchtime, and then nothing happened afterwards. And I find myself, I have Facebook friends that share crap on my feed about how, you know, we need to be like the sun and let our warmth radiate. And I just think about how catastrophic that would be if we're all like the sun. And I just feel like now, with this intelligent audience in the room, now is not the time for that type of stuff. So hopefully we can share something around motivation, strategy, and design. This is important because typically what happens in business, and we're all part of a bigger business, strategy is somehow determined and there's high-stakes stuff that goes on and then people go off and execute it. And I'm curious about what actually informs this strategy. For many organizations I've worked with, there was this really dark era where the rally cry of any strategy meeting was, let's build an app. And so they'd go off and build an app that had no strategic merit whatsoever, and they'd be left with this app that was doing nothing for the business. And then they would decide, oh, well, that didn't work for us. That type of digital strategy doesn't work. We can inform and enrich this, and this is exactly what these events do. The thing is, we are up against what I like to call the inevitable kraken of doom, which is fueled by default thinking. Now, default thinking is the threat that we're up against when we go back to our work as usual. We need default thinking. 80% of the time, it is absolutely fantastic. Kids, from a young age, you give like a baby an object, and the first thing they'll do is they'll drop it. And you give it to them again, and they'll drop it. And I should be actually, sorry, a bit more careful with this. So I think it still works. But eventually, they repeat that pattern enough times, they're able to codify that experience in their brain, and then what we have is a cognitive shortcut. So we see the signs that pattern's going to manifest again, and we don't have to think what's going on here. We have a cognitive shortcut. Later, we're given the label for it. It's called gravity. But in business, we have those types of things occur. We have established ways of doing things. And we have that because we've observed these repeated patterns over time, and that gives us the ability to take cognitive shortcuts. Now, this is great most of the time, but it can lead to this curse of efficiency, where people are so efficient at doing work that we don't actually make time for the pioneering work. Now, many of us would think, with all the clever systems that we have, the productivity tools that we have, that we'd have more time to actually lean into the challenge of slower thinking. If anyone's read the book Thinking, Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, it creates a dichotomy. He suggests there's a dichotomy between fast thinking and slow thinking. Fast thinking is our default thinking. The definition for default is the option we choose automatically in the absence of viable alternatives. That's what we do when we default to our defaults. We just go with the option we choose automatically in the absence of viable alternatives. The other type of thinking there is slow thinking. I think slow thinking does slow thinking a disservice. I like to call it thorough thinking. The ability for us to sit in curiosity, to sit in angst, to sit in doubt, to find what is a better pathway for us. Now, that's very much what this conference experience is about. There's new ways. There's ways beyond the default. But if we simply subscribe to the default, and this is what can happen in many organizations where some of the folks that I work with, when it comes to strategy meetings, everyone's so busy, so by the time you get people in the one room together, it takes a lot of work and it's hard to align calendars. They rock up there and someone's thought about the ROI, so they thought, okay, in order to get the value out of this, we need to have a 30-minute increments in the agenda of all the topics that we need to cover, and then people are sitting around this room together, and if you're doing strategy well, it's angsty. If you're considering new opportunities, new pathways, it's angsty work because sometimes people have poured their heart and soul to establish the defaults that we have, which means they're going to get defensive about some of the things that we have because sometimes strategy means saying no to the established things that we've got. And then it gets kind of angsty, but it's a good angst. But then someone will look at their watch and say, oh, come on, guys, we've got the agenda here. And then we'll default to the lowest common denominator. We'll all have harmony, and everyone will agree. And then we'll get to the end of the day, and we'll end up looking at this list of goals that looks eerily similar to last year's set of goals because we've succumbed to the default thinking. And if we do this too often, if people don't listen to folks like you who go to events like this, we'll end up going along the default growth arc of an enterprise. This could also be said of relevance for anyone. Anything starts at a startup phase. This is where we value new thinking. If this new thinking meets a market need, we may experience growth. Now, many startups don't get to this stage. Well, many startups do, but then fail during the growth stage because you end up having some companies move from 4 employees to over 100 in a very short space of time. Culture goes out the window and it all collapses. But let's say you do. We can enter a stage of maturity here. This is where we have policies, procedures, defaults that are well established. But if we're not careful in this maturity phase, we can start to suffer from the curse of efficiency. We can default too often to the defaults that we have established and not lean into the uncertainty, the complexity, the heaviness, the doubt that comes with pioneering work. And if we don't lean into this pioneering work, then we can end up entering decline and meeting the inevitable kraken of doom. It's been fascinating watching what Microsoft have done in recent times. We'll get to that. The key is what you're doing right now. In order to get beyond this, we need to get good at exploring options. Remember that the default is the option we choose automatically and the absence of viable alternatives. Upon reflection at this event, it is very likely that you have a set of viable alternative options for some of the things that you're doing. And when you go back to have those conversations with the people in your workspace about what these options are, it'd be good for you to have these mapped out, because once you've got these options, you then have the ability to conduct experiments which can inform and enrich strategy to make better decisions around the things that we progress. If you don't come to events like this, if you don't come have conversations with new people, if you don't stay connected with each other, then our ability to tap into viable alternative options is vastly diminished, which means we have dud strategy and we progress quicker towards irrelevance. If we do take these viable alternatives on board, then we can possibly circumvent the inevitable kraken of doom by embarking upon new growth arcs. So that's the challenge for us. Because right now for you, while you've been here, you've had emails accumulate in your inbox. There is busyness awaiting you when you get back. It'll be very easy for you just to hop back into that slipstream and get busy again, and for a year to pass, and for you to come to another event like this, get inspired again, and find yourself busy again. So we need to disrupt this pattern. And I'd like to suggest some non-fist-pumping rah-rah approaches to doing this as we begin to pioneer beyond to the future of work. Now, in motivation research, I did my PhD in this space, there's a wonderful term that academics like to use called constructive discontent. I love it. Constructive discontent. It recognizes that there is a discrepancy between your current state and your desired future state. Constructive discontent. Now, there's nothing wrong with being content, by the way. I had about 5 consecutive seconds of happiness the other week, and that was lovely. But if we're content for too long, I mean, we all know people that are quite content. We should pity them, because contentness is so close to comfort, which is so close to complacency, which is so close to the inevitable kraken of doom. We want to be blessed with dissatisfaction. We want to look at what we're doing and see that there's so much more that we could be doing. There's whole new pathways, there's new avenues that we can lean into, because that is what leads us on the pathway to relevance. But there's a gap between those two spaces, between where we are and where things could be. And I think that in the past, the two dominant schools of thought when it comes to motivation have done this gap a major disservice. The first is, so weird, like, I don't know what to do here. Like, some motivational speakers have Ferraris up on stage. I wish there's, I don't know if there's, can anyone get a, anyway, I might bugger it up. But anyway, there's this school of thought, the classic motivational school of thought, that works on attitudes and beliefs. Now, if you've ever had business coaching, it can be transformational. This stuff can be phenomenal. It can help you identify stuff that you've got running in your mind that's just hopeless for you. But there's a high chance that you can end up like, a lot of this stuff just doesn't work. There are people out there that have decided overnight that they're going to become a life coach. They go get business cards printed with butterflies on them because butterflies symbolize transformation. And they end up, you have these conversations or business coaching and stuff like that, working on these internal motivators and drivers, and I think a lot of it benefits from the Hawthorne effect, which is a scientific bias which says that your performance will naturally increase by the fact that you're aware that you're being observed. So simply having these conversations, if you were to get together with a friend, have these conversations once a month and review where you're at and what you're working on, you're naturally going to increase your performance. I think this path is fraught with peril, though, because, I mean, I was at a conference once where there was this lady saying, "Did you know that the bumblebee is apparently so heavy that according to the laws of aerodynamics, it should not be able to fly?" Well, you know what? No one told the bumblebee. Okay? No one told the bumblebee, and people are going to tell you that you can't fly. Well, I say, you just let your wings shine, okay? You just let your wings shine. And then the person, I was sitting at the back on my device just checking my email, and the person next to me was writing in her notebook, let wings shine, and underlined the word shine 3 times as though it'd be a useful strategy to refer to when motivation was low. Meanwhile, I just searched for bumblebees and flight, and in less than 0.36 seconds, the search engine told me that bumblebees' wings have manifolds that are arranged in a way that create mini cyclones, which help keep them aloft despite their volume to weight ratio, which is utterly fascinating. The thing is, for us to get curious and fascinated about this means we have to step into a space of slower, more thorough thinking, whereas there's a world of default throwaway motivational cliche lines and leadership cliche lines that we can hear. You know, just believe in yourself, just trust yourself, all that stuff, right? We need to get good at getting curious. We need to get good at leaning in the space of like almost like a scientific curiosity. If you want more of a particular behavior to manifest in your life, let's get curious about it. If you want your team or your clients or customers to engage in particular behavior, it's something we can get curious about. Unfortunately, in a business context, the other space that many folks find themselves jumping into is that of goal setting. Who here has endured a presentation on smart goal setting before? It's fine for formulaic work with predictable outcomes, but it's hopeless for pioneering work. We don't even know what the goal exactly looks like. And so we're left with, you know, those options too, by the way. Smart goal setting, particularly incentivized goal setting, can lead to collapses in collaboration, turn it into competition. Creativity can turn into conformity. It's nasty. So we're left with this third space, this space that is in the middle between where we are and where we want things to be. Now, Jerry Seinfeld was once rumored to have been paid an obscene amount of money to speak about his secrets to success. And I quite like this. It was in his local city, and he was only speaking for 5 minutes, and there was a big room, bigger than this, lots of people there. He's introduced, ladies and gentlemen, Jerry Seinfeld here to show his secret to success. And he walked up on stage, gave everyone a nod. There was a flip chart on the stage. He took out a pen. He wrote 3 words, put the pen down, nodded, and walked off. And for the next 4 minutes and 50 seconds, people stared at these 3 words, his secret to success, which I quite like. Those 3 words were, do the work. Which, for anyone who's read The Secret, which is a book about how the universe loves you, and as you visualize, you actualize, and all your dreams will be manifest, it might have been disappointing. But for the rest of us, it's a really important calibration. In order to get motivated to progress with these new hunches, we need to find the opportunities inherent within the work itself. Now, there was research conducted and published in the Harvard Business Review that asked the question of over 600 managers, what is it that gets people most enthusiastic about doing work? These guys were given a bunch of good answers to choose from. I'm going to repeat this list twice, so I want you to think about what the number one thing is. These are distilled down from various meta-analyses. Was it recognition for good work, interpersonal support, clear goals and targets, incentives and rewards, or a clear sense of progress? A clear sense of progress, incentives and rewards, interpersonal support, clear goals and targets, or recognition of good work? Now, token thing for extroverts in the room, I'd like you to turn to the person next to you, your temporary BFF, let's see how they go, and I'd like you to mumble to them what you think the number one thing is. Don't say it too clearly, just mumble to them. Out of the options I shared, what is the number one thing? I'm going to give you about 6 seconds for that. And magic. Wow, you are a riotous crowd. Good. What they found the number one thing was recognition for good work, which has an appeal for old school corporate thinking. What it doesn't mean is completing the second half of your feedback sandwich. You know, where you give a wafer thin slice of positive feedback and then a whole heap of shitty feedback laced with personal attacks. And then another... You know, another sliver of, positive acknowledgement and then see you again in 12 months. It's not that. It's recognizing good work and providing feedback proximal to the activity. What the researchers thought might be novel, however, is they thought, why don't we ask the employees themselves? Or better yet, let's follow a bunch of employees over several years analyzing over 12,000 journal entries to see what correlates to the highest levels of motivation at work. Turns out what the managers ranked as dead last is what came out as number one, and that is a clear sense of progress. which for anyone who plays video games, this should relate very, very closely to, a clear sense of progress. This was the number one breakthrough idea from the Harvard Business Review in 2010. But it's still something that many of us in the conventional business approach seem to neglect. We seem to focus on distant goals, but rather than finding the small wins in every day. But of course, anyone who's using Agile methodologies or Lean methodologies will have feedback loops built in. This is so important. This is all about reducing the latency between effort and meaningful feedback. The more those feedback loops are short-circuited, the more likely we are to put effort into things. The challenge is, though, you leave an event like this, what are the things that provide the richest sense of progress? It's the default stuff. When you get back to work, it's the default stuff. You get back to work, you have 94 emails in your inbox. You know, a half a day later, you've whittled it down to 42. It feels like you're winning, right? It feels like you're winning. You're making progress. You're trying to progress this new stuff, though, and unless you're good at getting visibility of progress, it won't happen. Many of us, when it comes to, you know, I do things where I'll sometimes geometrically align things. There's nothing for me to align at the moment, so maybe it's just an OCD thing. I have a friend who procrastinates, so she'll bake cupcakes as a form of procrastination, see the sense of progress. And I know that many of us, when it comes to writing down lists of things to do, will write down things that we've already done, just so that we can tick it off and get that sense of progress. We love progress. We love seeing progress. We love that knowing that our efforts contribute to progress. And if we don't have visibility of progress in the things that matter, this pioneering work, progressing these hunches at events like this, we'll find ourselves doing more of the busy work. So I want to give you a framework around how we can do this. And this was inspired when I was doing research at university. I found myself, I was at the forefront of motivation science, lecturing at three universities and teaching school students how to set goals and all that crap. And I was... I had goals myself. I had goals for my finances, for goals for my fitness, goals for my thesis writing, and yet I was playing a lot of World of Warcraft. it was kind of sad because people at the university would compliment me on how late I worked, how hard I worked, and I know. And I'd go to the office and close the blinds and log into Azeroth, where I was a level 40 Blood Elf Rogue, back in the time where it was quite a grind to get the level 40. I was so excited about getting my first mount, which... once I got it, I realized I'm just riding some ostrich that makes me move just slightly faster. It wasn't really that exciting. But I was the guild alchemist. So my job was to make potions for the guild. Health potions, mana potions, stamina potions, potions of visibility, potions of speed, potions of stamina, potions of vulnerability. You know, I was pretty much Breaking Bad in this game. You know, I was the one who knocked. Got a lot of respect. A lot of respect from 13-year-old boys and sad old men. No, the demographics are quite balanced and well. But the thing is, I was playing this game at the exclusion of all other goals and progress. It was only when I was moving house, I lost my internet connection for enough time to realize, something was going on here. Somehow this game was more effective than most of the classic motivational tools that I was using, and I got curious about what was going on. I tried to share this with the academics at the university, and they said, people only play games to avoid work as an escapist form of entertainment, which got me curious, because like if you look at the game of golf, say, I don't play golf, by the way, the sun is my arch nemesis, so does anyone play golf? Yeah? Oh, cool, good one. I play mini golf. Anyway, if you look at the game of golf, the goal is to get the ball in the hole in the least number of shots, and one could say that you could just pick up the ball and walk over to the hole, put it right next to the hole and take your shot from there. And your return on effort would go through the roof, right? Your efficiency would be amazing. You could get systematized, and if you had a drill, let's say that's a drill, you could drill a hole in your desk and then drop the ball in the hole anytime you wanted to win the game of golf, right? You could have tubes, circular tubes, multiple tubes set up with balls running through holes. Don't think about that too much. And that's the first time I've said that a few times. Yeah, there you go. And you'd be winning the game of golf. Of course, games don't work like this. They have rules to make it difficult. People don't play games to avoid work. They play games to engage in well-designed work. And this is key. They don't play games to avoid work. We play games to engage in well-designed work. Even like games of Scrabble, you look like you're half constipated through most of the game. It's something that we play with my family. Every Christmas, you know, there's a Scrabble comp where we all play. And most of the time, we're looking pretty constipated because we just... someone's just stolen our triple word space and we're left with these crappy letters and so on. But at the end of it, you think, that was fun. And this is curious because this stuff is not about avoiding hard work, it's actually making work inherently motivating. And so if we look at this through the lens of motivation, strategy, and design, and you look at the challenges in front of you, which is essentially, how do we nurture and cultivate the hunches developed at events like this? How do we nurture and maintain these new potential connections that we have and carry them forward and begin to try to create some visibility of progress along the way, so this time next year we can actually look back and see, wow, we've actually used this, we've developed, we've conducted some experiments, we might possibly unlocked new growth arcs or new value for our business. How do we do that? One potential solution is to look at it like through the lens of game design. The common ingredients of all games are simply goals, rules, and feedback. All games are, whether it's a board game, a sports game, a video game, are simply the interplay of goals, rules, and feedback. A good game is a goal-driven, challenge-intense, and feedback-rich experience geared towards progress. But just because something is a game doesn't mean it's good. And I think that for a while, the term gamification has distracted us, and there's been a whole heap of very, very poor user experience, very, very poor game design that has led to poor experiences. Just because it's a game doesn't mean it's good. But if something's not working for you in terms of your motivation, in terms of the desired behaviors manifesting for yourself, for your team, for your clients and customers, then looking through the lens of game design can be really interesting. Goals, rules, feedback. You know, if you think about any project that you've undertaken, that could be viewed through a lens of game design. Projects have a goal, they have an objective, they have rules. You have this much time and this much budget to achieve this. And there's feedback. Are we on track? Are we hitting our KPIs? So any project you've undertaken could be viewed through a lens of game design. If you've driven to work, that could also be a game. You have a goal to get to work in a certain amount of time, and you've got road rules and speed limits and things like that to obey, and you've got the feedback. How did we go? Is there a better route? Does anyone here cook? Cool. Has anyone got Jamie Oliver's 30-Minute Meals? Yeah, cool. I love that book. Rogan and Josh, we cooked the other night, which is nice curry. Whenever we're cooking Jamie Oliver's 30-Minute Meals, the goal is to cook it in under an hour and 50 minutes. And the rules are this incredibly complex sequence of ingredients. The feedback is, does it look even remotely like the picture, and are we emotionally stable? There's games that we play throughout all different elements of life. Now, if you've been following the motivation research, you'll see that these three elements correlate perfectly to what Dan Pink would describe as the three elements of intrinsic motivation. There are more than this, but if you were to distill it down to just three, there is a nice overlap. Goals, when linked with purpose, create great meaning for our work. The rules give us and the ability to develop mastery. This is interesting. In ancient Japan, there's a martial arts called Aikido, which I really like. It's all about non-harm. So someone's trying to attack you, and it's about getting off the center of balance and kind of just non-harm. I do a similar thing with networking at events. Like, I'll be walking around, I'll see someone trying to approach me, and I'll just kind of veer off and so on. And you can kind of walk confidently, ping-ponging about the room and not having to talk to anyone. It's beautiful. In Japan, though, you would spend decades as a white belt, and then you become a black belt. And when the Marines came to Okinawa after the war, they saw the black belt moves, like, I don't know, fireballs and stuff and dragon punches, and they thought, wow, I want to do that. But they tried to do that and they hurt themselves. They also didn't have the patience to spend decades as a white belt. So what they did is they developed a belt system, white, yellow, green, blue, red, black. Different levels of challenge to focus on relative to the skill level. What these set of rules did was allowed them to develop a level of mastery close to what the Japanese had in a much shorter amount of time. So when you're thinking about this hunch that you have and how you progress this, it's worth thinking about what are the artificial constraints that you want to put into play to make you more likely to lean into the relevant challenges at the right time. What is the sequence of activities that you want to step into? And of course, feedback enhances autonomy. If something's not working, we can try something else. That is the lens of game design. Now, I have no idea what I was intending to do with this slide, but there you go. There's a caricature of a fox sitting on an island. Let that be a lesson to us all. This is a model which I'm quickly realizing I might not have a full amount of time for to go into depth, but if you can kind of imprint it in your mind, I think this will be quite useful. The other element in this is we often leave these events and then there's just no time because everything is busy. I developed this to help people think in terms of contextual momentum. This is also partly to stick it to any motivational speaker that tells high school students they need to know exactly where they want to be in 10 years' time. I've seen this happen. What job will you have? What car will you drive? Oh, dude, we have no idea what happens in 10 years' time. The further things get into the future, the fuzzier things are. But the closer things are to where we are today, the more proximal things are, the more specific we can become. And so what I suggest we do is think through what are the rituals that we can start to embrace that'll help us to progress these things that matter, because it's so tempting. It's like there's a siren call for default work. It's so tempting, so immediately gratifying to just do emails, to just do the things that we always do. How do we carve out time to progress these new hunches? And so if we look at daily and weekly, we're more focused on how. How are we actually going to do this? What happens at the monthly and quarterly, and why is a conversation that happens throughout? Now, most of us are pretty savvy with digital, I imagine, and there's a population out there that is very savvy with paper-based things, tools and stationery. I still like paper-based. Does anyone here love stationery? Like, loves the feel of good paper and stuff like that? I still do. So we blend in the two. You can call it digilog, analog and digital. Regardless of what your preference is in terms of your time management tool, the default day view, the default view you'll have is either a day view, a week view, or a month view. We're often locked out from the precious quarterly view, which I think is a big opportunity. Each quarter, I suggest you choose three projects that matter as a ritual. Choose three projects that matter. They could be ideas that are harvested from events like this. These are the projects that you find yourself saying, we really should do that, but then you don't have time for. They're the projects that you find your team saying, we really should update this, we really should move our database to this, we really should try this. And everyone agrees, but no one has time for it. Three projects that matter. We don't choose one, because if we choose one, we'll procrastinate over it. So we'll make it too important, we'll procrastinate over it, and we'll end up not getting it done. If we choose two, we'll enter binary mode, and we'll be constantly assessing which one's more important. Three is a magic number, because once we have three, we can then actively seek to fail 50% of them. The reason, this is important, you guys will get this, right? The reason being is that the opposite of success is not failure, it's apathy, it's the non-doing of things. It's very, very easy to justify busyness as a cloak and a mask to get nothing done. In science, there's no such thing as failure, there's only disproven hypotheses. The only way you can effectively disprove a hypothesis is by collecting evidence, which means you're doing stuff. And so there's three projects that matter, or three experiments that matter, is a really, really important ritual. Each month you can then check, oh, is this still aligned to us? Is this still working for us? Or should we quit this project? Should we fail it? Each week we can identify the friction around it. What's getting in the way? For some teams, this is just a beer or wine at the end of the week. Looking back, what's getting in the way here? And each day we can have a ritual to identify our three mission critical actions. This is really important. A lot of people start their days by checking emails, instantly entering the world of reactive work in which you're responding to other people's urgencies. If there's one thing that you can do after this event is to carve out some time for a morning ritual, a ritual in which you get meta. You start thinking about what you're thinking about. You get metacognitive. You escape default thinking, and you think, what can I push forward today? And you start to build that time in before you get swept up in the busyness of other people's priorities. Have that one thing, and so many other things work better. We've got two other things in here. We have a decade and beyond. I don't even know what that looks like. I call it the EverQuest. If you don't know what the meaning of life is, that's fine. Just keep searching. And each year, I suggest, instead of a New Year's resolution, I suggest you choose one word. A New Year's resolution is far too binding. People break it. Whereas if you choose one word for your year, it's much more liberating. If you were to think back on your life as an autobiography over the last 12 months and think, what is a theme? If there was one word to describe this theme, if this book was written about your life, what is that one word? For many people, it's hectic, tumultuous, busy, and stuff like that. That's fine. But here we are right now. If we think between now and the next time this conference is on, a year into the future, if there was one word to describe the theme of what your life is going to be like, what do you want that word to be? For me this year, my word is pirate, which is all about leaning into uncharted territories and, you know, being buoyant and jolly and optimistic and drinking more rum and that type of thing. I had the word kingly 3 years ago, which is all about stepping up, growing the beard, writing my first book, and so on. I wonder what that word might be for you. These words that we have, the themes that we have in our own life, influence some of the projects that matter and the mission critical actions that we lean into. And as I begin to wrap up, I forget what my next slide is, but let's have a look here. Oh yes, my book, The Game Changer, is available somewhere in this event. I don't know where, but somewhere afterwards. If you don't have to run away, I might be able to see you then. And if you want to find out any more about this stuff, I have a newsletter. This is just drjasonfox.com/pew. That's the sound a laser makes when you shoot it. Pew! And you're welcome to join up there. Now, there's a thing, though. I want to leave with you this. There's a couple of quotes that I want to leave with you. That we have the opportunity, of course, to get really curious about the motivation that we have. I'm going to leave you with two quotes. The first is by James Cass. He's the author of Finite and Infinite Games, a philosophy book in which he says that finite players play within boundaries, infinite players play with boundaries. Very much the work that you're doing is playing with the boundaries that exist now. If that quote didn't do it for you, I've got another one. This one's from Andrew Ryan. He's the founder of Rapture, an underwater city in a game called Bioshock. He says, we all make choices, but in the end, our choices make us. Thank you for choosing to be here. You're doing wonderful work, and I look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thanks, Jason. That was very cool. And when you think about it, what we've given you this week is a lot of how, right? We've done a whole lot of how. And when you get back, take the how and put it in context of your organization and the what and see where it's going to lead you for the why, right? But I was trying to think of a word that I could use for next year, and it's probably HoloLens. But I kept getting distracted wondering how long it takes him to button that vest. That's very impressive. I like the vest. But hopefully you've got some tools now. You know, you can take the what, wrap it in the how, and you'll be able to get this stuff done. Let's not worry about that. Okay, so now the moment you've all been waiting for very patiently, and we love you for it, is we would like to give away some stuff. You all right with that? All right. All right, so first off, I would like to invite our platinum sponsor, Optus, up on stage. So from Optus, we have Dale Beebe. And from Insist, we've got Mark Gillard to come up and give away some cool stuff for you. How you doing, Dale? Mark? Thanks. Cool. I'll play the showgirl. We have better showgirls in here. It's all right. All right, so what we're going to do, Optus, as you know, they put the thing in your bag, and there's three prizes here, third place, second place, and first place. And the first one we're going to give away is for third place, right, which is going to be for the Surface Pro 4. So, Mark, if you'd like to draw a winner, let's see what we got.
Thank you. The winner is Damien Calvert of the Australian Ballet.
Where are you,
Damien? Damien, make yourself known.
Jump up and scream. Where are you? Wait, no, really. Is that you, Damien?
Here he comes.
If that's Damien, dance your way down here. All right.
Okay, let's move
on. All right, we're on to it. Keep going. Second place, a Surface Pro 4 and a Lumia phone.
And the winner is Harry Sayari of Campaign Monitor Proprietary
Excellent.
Limited.
So Dale's going to give you this. Here you go. Come on down. Wait, where are you? Ah, there we go. Come on down. All right. And without further ado, for the grand prize of a Surface Pro 4 Lumia and an Xbox One.
And the winner is Hariam Sharma of Sentiment Systems.
Where are you? Jump and scream.
Make yourself known.
No, really.
Here he comes.
Ah, there we go. Come on down. All right, thank you very much. Walk faster, man. Everybody. Cool. So thanks again to Optus, our platinum sponsor for this year. One of two.
There you go. Thank you.
Excellent.
Congratulations to the winners.
Great, thanks. Thanks, Dale. All right. Excellent. That's it. That's mine. All right. So our second platinum sponsor of this event this year is obviously AvPoint. And it's become kind of a TechEd/Ignite tradition for our platinum sponsor to give away the dirt bike. Anybody want to win it? All right, let's do this. I'd like to invite Eric Francella on stage from AvPoint to come and we're going to give away the bike. All right, let's pull this thing out and give it a spin. You gonna spin it? We should spin it. He knows how to work this thing. It's too complicated for me. It's got holographic pins. All right, let's roll this thing around. Now, all of you have torn off your little thing that came in your bag and you put your number in here, right? Cool, mine are all in here. All right, what do we have? You got to be here. All righty. A, go figure, 0486. Going once. Going to, screw it. Next. 0486. Nobody want it? I'll take it later. Next. A, 0736. Oh, there we go. We have a winner. Come on up. So we're expecting you to ride this off the stage, and no, my friend would kill me if he did that. Mind if I, that looks close, that's it, all right. Congratulations, nice job, John. Thanks. All right, now before you go, pretty please before you go, I know some of you have planes to catch, and I'm okay with that. But we do want to thank a few people, and to be honest, a lot of this, stay, isn't possible without them. So we'd love to thank our platinum sponsors, our volunteers, our other sponsors that have been entertaining you in the expo hall. Hopefully you had enjoyed Freebie Friday, one of my favorite parts. And whoever took the two Millennium Falcons with the AvPoint Lego thing, whatever. Okay, I was hoping for that. But I'd like to thank them very much. And to be honest, none of them would be here, none of us would be here if it wasn't for you guys. So thank you very much as well. Thanks for coming up here, spending your time with us. We really appreciate that, okay? Now, I personally want to thank a few specific people, not least of which is Fran Barlow over here. She puts the whole thing together. We've got Sammy, Catherine, Megan, Nathan, Jeff, who put the content together. We've got Michael Kodahi, who does the keynote and lock note, and wait, you can thank me for Michael, it's okay. And then Des, Brad, Sarah, and the Jack Morton crew, all these people in black shirts that have put this whole thing together for you. And we really appreciate it. And hopefully, we're going to see you next year for Ignite 2016. So stay tuned for when and where, okay? Thank you very much, everyone. We'll see you later.